Welcome to Music for Youth presents The Right Track Podcast with me, your host, Matt Haynes. This episode we have Pete the Tanker, the educator, jazz pianist, performer and composer who is presenting Primary Live at our national festival in Birmingham. We also have our celebrations for the King's Coronation which are happening nationally from the 5th of May to the 8th of May. Hope you enjoy. Welcome to Music for Youth presents The Right Track Podcast with me, your host, Matt Haynes. And today's guest is Pete the Tanker. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So with our guests, I always like to start from the beginning. And so I was just wondering, were you brought up in a musical household? And what are your earliest musical memories?
So yeah, I was. My father was a doctor and he also used to play piano. And my mother wasn't very musical, but always saw the importance of music. So we all had to learn, kind of forced into learning the piano from the age of about 5. And I think the rule was we had to get up to grade 5 before we could give up. So yeah, that was how it was. And I think me and my two sisters did it. And then my sisters actually stopped when they were probably 15, 16 or something. But I actually kept going. And I think when I was about 17, realized I actually wanted to turn it into a proper career. And your second question, sorry, was my first musical memory?
Yeah, your sort of earliest musical memories that you can remember.
Well, I was obsessed with Prokofiev's Peter and the Wolf. I loved all the music of Benjamin Britten. And I loved sort of the Andrews sisters and Fats Waller, Scott Joplin, all that really old jazz. And also my father's from South Africa. So we used to have just old records of this South African jazz opera called King Kong, not the giant ape, but an amazing opera about an incredible South African boxer who was as strong as King Kong. So I grew up listening to all of those kind of scratchy old records. And my mum said I was just obsessed that I'd get to the end of the record and then would want her to start it all over again. So I think, that my earliest memories must have been listening to those scratchy old records.
Yeah, it's amazing. I've got a lot of my father's vinyl, and it's amazing the sort of early stages of your musical development when you hear all your parents sort of records and stuff. It does go into your system, doesn't it? It really does.
We had Boris Karloff narrating Peter and the Wolf, and I still have, like, whenever the bit when the wolf eats the duck and Boris Karloff's low rumbling voice says, "and swallowed him whole." And when the French horns kick in, I mean, I still get panics. So yeah, I get flashbacks.
You're a wonderful jazz pianist. I've listened to loads of different things in preparation for this. Really sort of emotive playing, sensitive, thoughtful. And I was just wondering, because of course it relates to the work we do here at Music for Youth, did you have like an instrumental sort of inspiring music teacher growing up?
Yeah, I mean, I started at 5 and I had about 3 teachers, I suppose, from between 5 and 15 or 16. And they were amazing, but I was constantly battling them because back then in the late 70s and, you know, 80s, the only way it seemed to my teachers that you could learn the piano was through the sort of European classical music model. And I was constantly frustrated by that because I really struggled to learn to read music. I was always improvising. I was always just sitting at the piano, picking out tunes and, you know, stumbling through chords and trying to find nice sounds. And the idea, the discipline of having to go back to much what I considered less sophisticated music, which was whatever, you know, the stuff that you need to learn to read with, felt like such a step back. And I was constantly frustrated by that. I mean, I don't know whether I was musically dyslexic, which I think is a thing. I don't really know much about it. But when I still really struggled with reading music, when somebody puts music in front of me, every musical instinct in my body closes down and my brain gets kind of flooded with information. It's like trying to read a book 3 lines at a time. I find it so hard to do. And so it was a constant battle with these teachers who kept saying to me, you can't have your cake and eat it. A meaning you can't, you've got to, you know, for the piano, you've got to learn when to tuck your thumb under so you don't run out of fingers. You've got to understand the harmony. You've got to get your bit theory down. Otherwise, you can't do anything. You can't be a jazz pianist. And my, you know, I don't know, I was such a willful child, I think, and genuinely couldn't understand it because I love playing the piano. I just wasn't that interested in the 100 or so classical piano pieces that, you know, I needed to study because I was listening to so much Scott Joplin and Fats Waller and, you know, the South African jazz opera, which is what I was obsessed with. And I feel like now the whole landscape has changed. I've just written some music for ABRSM's jazz syllabus. And, you know, I'm just thinking, I wish I had something like that. So you can work your way through the grades, work out technically, theoretically, harmonically, all the stuff you need to learn to master any instruments, but do it within the context of music that really moves you. And finally, it feels like we can do that now.
That's so interesting. I'm so glad that you've brought that up. Because I think that, I think with reading, I think that there is, you know, I can only speak from my own experience and the experience of people I've seen around me and stuff growing up in terms of people's musical journey. But we need to sort of address that, you know, people can be exceptional musicians and not read, you know what I mean? Or struggle to read music. It's just like, given a great example, especially in the jazz and the pop and rock worlds, you know, plenty of people, you know, I my background's really sort of rock and pop and stuff, and all of my heroes didn't read, you know what I mean? And you know, Clapton, McCartney, list goes on and on and on. And it's just like, I suppose what I'm saying is that you can still be an incredible musician without being an amazing reader, you know what I mean? And I don't think people talk about that enough.
And the thing is, it feels like, I mean, all the, you know, back in those days, it feels like the, whatever they say, the sorry, I forgot what the term is, but like we've become more pious than the Messiah. Do you know what I mean? Like the followers have become more pious than the Messiah. We're so bowing down to like Mozart and Chopin, Bach and Beethoven. Of course, these are absolute geniuses. But if all we're doing is if all we're doing is basically reproducing the music they made, we, I think, miss their genius and their soul and their essence and everything that makes them important and relevant today if all we can do is recreate their music. Because, of course, they were all composers, they were all creators, they were improvisers. They couldn't, you know, that was at the heart of their musicianship, as it always was. And now suddenly where improvisation gets relegated to the likes of, you know, jazz musicians, church organists, rock musicians, people who, you know, but it used to be a big sort of, it was an expression of your musical prowess. And for that to be relegated to the sidelines of musicianship feels like such an oversight. But also, as you say, how many young musicians are we losing because they're being sort of, because the only way we can sort of grade them, or a massive part of their grading, is them being able to read music. That feels crazy. And also, I think when I was 15, I was just about to give up because this constant battle with my teachers, I mean, the absolute massive battles I had with my teachers all the time. And when I'd say I just wanted to give up the piano, I hate the piano, I tear up my music. I mean, I was awful. And my parents said, why they never let me is I couldn't walk past the piano without wanting to sit down and play it. And so I was clearly obsessed with the instrument, but just the way of learning was frustrating. And actually, it was chord symbols, which I learned when I switched at 15 to a jazz teacher, was what suddenly, well, I was free. And
everything fell into place.
I was suddenly had the possibility of being a musician, which was, I felt like every door was closing to me up until then.
Oh, that's so interesting. And I'm so glad we brought that up as a topic. I think it's massively important. Yeah, I'm based in London, and the jazz scene down here, when I first moved here, I didn't quite realize how massive it was in the city. Yeah. It's absolutely huge. So what is it about the genre for you that makes it so special, and what made it connect with you the most with jazz?
Well, I think, again, that sort of willful side of me, possibly. I think, well, first of all, I suppose just something in me responded to 20th Century Harmony. Some part of me was slightly left cold by triads and always wanted to have extended harmony. That just moved me. So I don't know where that came from. But I think with jazz, I'm not a gamer, but I used to play lots of games when I was younger, and the games that I used to love were those open world games. And I always used to be frustrated by sort of, you know, whatever they're called, platform, and I don't know all these terminologies, but those games where you're basically, you know, you're on quite a tight road. I love those open world games where you could explore. And jazz to me is exactly that. It is that open world game where you can use all your knowledge of harmony, use all your knowledge of how melodies are constructed, use all of your knowledge of how to approach your instrument in terms of phrasing, in terms of all the technique, everything, but you're driving it, you're creating it, you're composing in real time, sometimes with an audience. And that challenge for me is it's the closest part of me. It's the part that resonates the most with music.
Just relating to what you just said there, I love what you've said about jazz being sort of this, and I certainly used to be more of one, but I am a bit of a gamer myself, and I love that idea of it being an open world jazz. I love that analogy. But also I think for me with jazz, and sort of relating to what you've just said as well, for yourself as a performer or anyone else in that genre, I suppose what jazz really has going for it, improvisation side of things, is that if you go to a jazz gig, it's going to be a bit, you know, the chances are it's going to be unique every time. You could go and see the same person, and if they're an exceptional improviser, you're going to have a unique experience. So when you pay for that ticket, you're going to get a different, unique experience every single gig.
Yeah. That's so true. And I mean, it's funny because I I'm also so aware of friends of mine who are playing in orchestras who are so vehemently, or just realistically just say, look, it is different every single night too. I just suppose that the bandwidth of how different you can be as a jazz musician, as opposed to somebody who is needing to recreate with them, that's the creativity of classical music every single time, every night. The bandwidth is enormous, obviously. So, and interesting that thing about sort of playing along with a backing track, you know, your bandwidth able to do something new and creative, you know, you can change your phrasing, you can change the attack on your note, you can all those things. But again, it's that bandwidth of creativity. And I think what I just find I've always loved about jazz is this absolutely broad bandwidth.
Oh, for sure. Moving on to your sort of own music education path, I found it really interesting that you studied both in the UK at Leeds, which I've got family in Leeds. I've lived in Leeds for 3.5 years. I love that city. And I know the Leeds College of Music very well. And you also studied in Maine. So for someone my age who was completely, I was on that wave of being fascinated with everything across in America, whether it be music, sport, all of that stuff. What were the differences in studying music in the UK and studying in America, sort of culturally and academically?
Yeah, I mean, you know, getting to Leeds in 94, I was there till 97. It was the only music college where you could get a degree in, a sort of undergraduate degree in jazz music. You know, the Academy, Trinity, Guildhall, all the other sort of conservatoires, Royal Norwich, they were all, but you know, you could get postgrads in jazz, but not, you couldn't get a BA or whatever it was, BMuz. So it was the place to go. So I was rubbing shoulders with, like, it felt like I was at Top Gun. You know, like these, everybody was like at the top of their game, and there was kind of egos kind of rubbing up against people. You know, some people collapsed under it, some people rose to it. It was a fascinating place to be, and playing with such inspiring, and meeting such inspiring musicians. And then winning this place, the scholarship to go and study at the University of Maine at Augusta, I studied with this extraordinary piano player called Mark Polishuk. I think it just won the Thelonious Monk Jazz Piano Competition. So it's like the Nobel Prize of the jazz world. And he happened to be studying, he happened to be teaching at this university up in Northern Maine. And he was just, he changed my world completely. And I don't know whether, I think it's an American and an English approach to jazz, but he somehow really personified it and really kind of underlined it in that I'd approach him with all the questions I had at Leeds, which was, what are my chord scale relationships? What can I play, you know, over these set of changes? It was just intellectual. It was like number crunching. And he looked at me like I was at the bottom of a well. He looked so baffled. And he just sort of said, what are you talking about? This is like, this is dance music. If what you should be, play one note. But if that note isn't swinging and you tell, because if people's toes aren't tapping, then you're dead in the water. So who cares about your scales? Play one note. But if this doesn't make people want to dance, if it doesn't move people, who cares about the scales? And it was a very different approach. And interestingly, I was there at the same time as some friends of mine who were studying classical music, who were English and studying classical music in America. And they had the inverse reaction. They had very much in England, they felt classical music was taught very much about the passion and the feeling and this and understanding what the feeling was. And in America, it was very intellectual. And I always wonder whether there's a thing of, you know, you it's with something that is yours, like European classical music, when it's studied by Americans, it feels foreign. And so they treat it with absolute reverence, and probably it becomes an intellectual thing, maybe more so than a heartfelt thing. I know that I'm talking in broad strokes, so I'm so aware of the nuance in all of this, but I think it certainly seemed that way with jazz, that in England it felt very much an intellectual approach, and in America it was an absolute soul approach.
Interesting. Very yeah. Interesting indeed. Moving on from that to your work as a performer and artist yourself, I'm just interested because the music industry is changing at such a pace, like not only just the past decade, but it seems now with streaming and various, you know, independent releases and approaches, you know, it's changing every few months almost, you know what I mean? Yeah. And when you were sort of a new artist coming through, I was just interested, what challenges did you face? And what's your feel of, what do you think are the positives and negatives of the industry at the moment?
Yeah. I mean, I think I was playing when I was, I guess, 28, 29. So a couple of years out of college, about six, seven years out of college. And I was playing in a band, and that band got signed by Zephyr Records, and who I'd loved Zephyr Records, amazing, independent, sort of award-winning jazz label that all my heroes from the British jazz scene were signed to or recorded for. And I did a few gigs, and suddenly the head of Zephyr Records, John Boone, came. I think we were playing at Ronnie Scott's, and came down and said he wanted to record me. And I was so excited and nervous, and so nervous that I think I left it for about 2 years before saying I'm ready. Until I realized, I think as a musician, I don't know whether you just have to do it. You know, I think you'll spend your life getting ready. And I needed that plunge, and somehow I've forgotten what it was that I just thought, I've got to do it. So I called him up, said, I'm ready to do this. And it was really interesting releasing music through Zephyr Records, because I think it was probably 2 years or maybe, it was coming towards the end of CDs and big record shops. And so then I wanted to be attached to a big or a record label, because they were the ones that could get my CD into record shops. And, you know, there are a few, not disagreements, weren't, it sounds too dramatic, it wasn't disagreements, but things where me and John Boone didn't see quite eye to eye on tiny things like some of the artwork, some of the liner notes. And he kept saying, and again, it wasn't threatening, but he just kept saying quite openly, look, you can always just release this independently. And I knew I didn't want to, because I knew I wanted it in shops. And so I didn't have to compromise much, but little bits. But I love the fact that I could go into Tower Records or HMV and Piccadilly Circus, those go through the jazz section where I spent all of my teens leafing through Miles Davis and Lee Morgan and Herbie Hancock out. And there suddenly in the L section was my album. I mean, that was a really magical moment for me. And I suppose, yeah, you had to jump through a few hoops to get there. And what I love about today's music scene is that you can sit in your bedroom with an old Mac or some computer, and you can put some pretty amazing things down, and you can reach a far wider audience than I ever could, that most musicians ever could, through record shops. And that feels really exciting as a consumer and a producer.
Relating to what you've just said, I think that's some quality points coming up in this podcast. But you do have to just go for it in the end, don't you? Because I know so many musicians of various ages, and you can just end up sort of talking about it forever, can't you? Do you know what I mean?
You've just got to go
take the plunge. And I still think in the industry overall, whatever genre anyone's in, the cream will always rise, even if it's an independent release, because if something's undeniable, then it's, you know, it will rise to the top, won't it?
Yeah. And I suppose that thing again of when you're ready is, I think half the skill of being, or part of the skill of being a musician, is having that sort of that courage to just commit yourself and just do it. Because, you know, music is, it's a craft, right? So we are all improving all the time. And so I know that even 2 weeks after recording that album, I'll look back and just think I could play better than that. Because we are all, one hopes that you do, you keep improving until the day you die. You keep learning, you keep growing. That's the whole joy, going back to this gaming thing, is it's a computer game that you can never complete. So it's an absolute joy. But I think the skill is to have the courage in it. And then the other skill is to have the courage to live with what you produced and not betray yourself and say, look, I made this when I was 26. That was exactly who I was at 26. Now I'm whatever age and I can't, you know, I'm going to be a different musician now. But I did that at 26 and I have to allow that to be in the world, even if it doesn't represent me now.
Yeah, no, completely. Very interested that you work as an educator as well, and you do, you know, great workshops and inspire a lot of children. I was just wondering, again, because this very much relates, again, to our work at Music for Youth, what traits do you think make a great music tutor, and what traits do you think make a great student?
Wow. I guess what makes a, well, I suppose what I think, actually, you know, I think it's both. I think it's what I've said, which is that both the tutor and the student both need to be able to be in a place where they're continuing to learn and grow. You know, I think that's the real key. I get so excited if I'm working wherever I'm working, as when I'm doing my education work, because somebody will say to me, have you listened to this? And I literally have one of my notes on my phone, which is just filled with the music that people have suggested to me. And whether that's a 7 or a 17 year old or a 27 or a 97 year old, I have these people, you know, working with, you know, in an educational setting, they just keep me growing. And I think the best tutors and best pupils are the ones who've got the capacity and space and interest to keep learning.
I also think about with music teaching, I mean, I haven't been a tutor for a long time now, but what I used to enjoy about it was when someone comes in, I mean, you can always develop someone's musical skill, obviously, but when someone comes in with a natural, a young person comes in with a natural talent, and it just, you know, someone's voice or someone's playing, and it just blows you away. Like, that never gets tiring, does it? Do you know what I mean? It's always so exciting.
I find it fascinating that you know, go on, sorry.
And I was just going to say, I think that's going to be, which we'll come on to shortly, but the joy about something like the Primary Live in July will be, it's just going to be this celebrating outstanding young musicians, and then, you know, the whole Primary Live event itself will be, because there'll be an interactive side of it for the audience. It'll be inspiring that next generation, and that's everything, isn't it, really?
Yeah. And I think also, like, I don't think it, you know, but I'm always surprised how the response that people have to music from being performed by people of all ages is somehow universal. in that, you know, they're, I was working in London the other day with some 7-year-olds who were just doing such amazing stuff on xylophones and bits of classroom percussion, and I had my trio, we were playing with them, and my response to these, you know, 7-year-olds or 8-year-olds, whatever age they were, primary school kids, was the same as I had the same responses when I'm playing with these kind of world-class, you know, musicians who are really seasoned, who have been trying to, you know, hone their craft for 25 years. It still feels exactly the same when something like, I don't know, when musicians, I guess, are working at the best of their ability, whatever that ability is. It's always inspiring.
Yeah, and I think music is the people's language, isn't it? And I think that it brings, you know, when you meet someone for the first time, you know, I've rarely in my life, like, honestly, I count on one hand when someone said, oh, I'm not really interested in music. It just, it's so rare. And it is the people's language.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you tell me a bit about your experiences with Music for Youth and our collaborations, Music for Youth collaborations in the past, and what you're looking forward to at this summer's primary live event?
Well, I mean, I've had such fun working with Music for Youth in so many different settings. You know, whether it's sort of, I brought some about 15 years ago, I was working in a primary school in London and brought them to one of the Music for Youth proms, and we performed a piece, and that was absolutely amazing to get feedback. I think Howard Goodall was doing it. I mean, that was incredible. And then sort of presenting concerts with them in Cornwall and writing with them in Cornwall. And that's been really fun. You know, I often get a brief of saying, these are the musicians who are working. Can you do something that involves them all? So I remember when, I think it was an anniversary of Nelson Mandela coming out of prison, and we were all sort of marking it and thinking of it. And there was a group of secondary school kids who had done that old, I've forgotten who did it now, track from the sort of late 80s called Free Nelson Mandela. And it was really fun writing, sort of arranging that for them to play, but then be joined by an amazing chorus that was from another part of the UK, joined by another kind of small orchestra, chamber orchestra from another part of the UK. And I suppose Music for Youth has always been, what I love about them is this thing about bringing people together, finding common ground, and making a really musically satisfying handshake upon that common ground.
Oh, that's a lovely answer. I'd like to touch on another one of your many talents. You're a composer, and I was just wondering that you've written music for documentaries and projects in the media and stuff like that. Do you, when you get given like a spec for a project, say a TV project, and they're like, we want something like this, or we want, you know, and they give you a reference point, do you think specs as a composer, sort of in terms of song specs, as it were, whether you're a composer, pop composer, classical composer, whichever, do you think it's better just to write from your heart and sort of write something real in the studio that sort of moves you and try and fit that into the actual project rather than being maybe overwhelmed by a strict spec?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question, because I think actually what we need to all be able to do is do both, because different jobs call for different things. I did an arrangement of the theme da, 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 from New York, New York, you know, for an amazing singer called Julian Ovenden, who was performing in Pasadena, California, with a huge orchestra, really good orchestra called the Pasadena Pops. It's like 10,000 people in the audience. It was a really big thing. And he'd said, "Can you?" It was actually a concert in tribute to Leonard Bernstein. It was about him living in New York. So they wanted to reimagine New York, New York, without relying too much on the old da 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 da. And that was quite interesting, because I wrote, spent ages scoring out, writing what I thought was really musically interesting, which was this kind of hustle and bustle of cars going past, massive trucks on the roads, you know, the sound of ships playing their foghorns on the Hudson. You know, it was the sound of the city, and that's how I started it. And I spent ages, all the strings, doing all this kind of really interesting textural work. I was really pleased with it, and I remember playing it to Julian, who's a is such a fascinating musician and a really interesting person to collaborate with, because he just said, "This is all you. This is completely." I mean, he said, "I love this, but this has nothing to do with what I'm asking you to do, which is, you know, which is to really find a way for me to sing this song in a new way. And this part is actually all about you." And that was a really interesting learning moment for me. And I realized that what I needed to do for him was to write something that covered the 15 seconds that it takes for him to walk from the side of the stage to the center of the stage, that the orchestra can do something bold, triumphant, fanfare-like, that announces his arrival, that says to the 10,000 people sitting, listening, "This guy's for real. This is, you've never heard this before. This is exciting." And that was a really interesting thing for me to learn about, not letting my ego get in the way of the spec.
Oh, that's a fascinating answer. I could, when you were talking about the Hudson River and all that, there, I was getting quite, because I'm quite fascinated with New York as a place. It's one of my favorite cities. Okay. And it does have, it's like, when I first went to New York, what I remember thinking was, it's like walking around a film set. And there's sort of, there's like music in the streets. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You can feel it.
Yeah.
And
Can I just say the other thing, though? Sorry, just because it's
not good for him.
I was just the first part of writing to spec being really useful. But then why I say it's so important to be able to do both is that when I was when Music for Youth commissioned me to do the finale for the Primary Prom at the Albert Hall, it must have been 2016 or 2017. What was amazing was to actually be given free rein. And so that was, yeah, and people kept saying, were they, you know, it's the first time the Music for Youth prom had ended in something other than Land of Hope and Glory. And so and that freedom was absolutely empowering. And so that basically, I think those two answers are essentially saying, I think we, as writers, as creative musicians, we need to have, if we're going to try and make a living from this, if we're going to try and be employed, which we all are trying to do, we need to be able to build in the flexibility to have moments that are a complete pure expression of ourselves and also work to spec so that we're serving the role that we're in.
I completely agree with that. A question that's a question has just come to me, and it's from just listening to what your answer there, because you spoke about ego, and I like these conversations when they sort of naturally go somewhere. And what I would like to ask you is something I feel strongly about is, and it's not just about music, it could be about the arts, could be about working in business, it could be about various things, but one thing I think a lot of people struggle with, whether they're 16 or into their 50s, is they can't get out of the way of their own ego. And I think so many people struggle with that so much. And what I was going to ask you was, because you mentioned ego in the last answer, was, do you think part of being a great musician is to sort of, you know, leave your ego at the door and be open to as much as you can?
It's such an interesting one, and it's such a complex one, because I think any musician has to have that ability to leave their ego at the door. It's interesting, you know, I'm working in educational settings, and I feel very much that my job there is sticking other people's ideas together. It will always flow through me if I'm leading the workshop, and it'll throw through my musical sensibilities. But beyond that, it's really important for me to leave my ego at the door so I can be completely open and receiving all of these ideas that will come from a room that I'm working with. But at the same time, there's an amazing music educator who trained me, who was head of the LSO, London Symphony Orchestra's Discovery Program, called Richard McNichol. And I remember sort of in 1998, you know, doing a sort of, you know, I just left music college and I was really interested in education. So I was going around many different practitioners as I could to see how they would work. And he was doing a workshop that I attended, and And somebody put a xylophone in front of me. So we were kind of doing stuff on xylophone, but there was a piano in the corner. And I thought that I was leaving my ego behind by not doing something that I've been studying at for ages, but doing a xylophone, which was kind of reducing the skills that I had. And I remember him saying to me, "Are you a piano player?" And me saying, "Yes." And him saying, "Well, why didn't you go on the piano?" And I said, "Well, should I not keep my ego out of this?" And he was just really interesting, because I remember him saying, don't ignore your ego, because otherwise you're not bringing the best of yourself to a situation. Be the musician you are, you know, be the best at being you." And I suppose that's the fine line, right, of that ego thing. Partly you want to have the modesty and the to be able to learn, but also but not at the expense of thinking that you silence everything, every part of yourself in order to learn. It's a really fine line that I think we all have to sail.
I was going to ask you what your best piece of advice you've been given in your musical career was, but we've got to run with that. That's maybe the line of the podcast or one of the lines we've had so far in the episodes is be the best at being you. Is amazing line. Sorry, who said that to you? Was that, because that line's magic. Who was that?
Well, I don't, I mean, it was so long ago, I don't know whether he said, but that was Richard McNichol, he was called. He was the head of LSO's Discovery Program. And that was essentially what he was saying. I mean, you know, there are so many different variations on that sentiment. There's a brilliant Thelonious Monk, amazing jazz pianist quote, who said that a genius is simply the person who's best at being themselves. Oh, you know,
beautiful.
I love
beautiful
isn't that
stuff.
Beautiful, right? Yeah, these things I think are vital.
Yeah, it's a wonderful sentiment. Absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, that conversation has literally just flown. But I was just going to ask a couple of fun ones, because we just like to get a sense of the person outside of their music, you know, them as well. A couple of fun questions at the end of the podcast. So we're throwing a dinner party. You can invite anyone, not just music, dead or alive, three guests. Who you're inviting?
Oh man. Well, I would say I would be fascinated to sit next to Muhammad Ali.
Oh, yes.
I think I'd be
love
fascinated
that.
To hear what he had to say. I'd be fascinated to sit next to Rosa Parks. I'd be fascinated to work out her story and what it took for her to move her position in the bus. I would be fascinated to sit next to Oscar Peterson, I think, who's my absolute all-time jazz piano hero.
Well, that's going to be a good dinner party. There's going to be plenty to talk about. Finally, I'm sending you off to a desert island, and I'm going to give you three albums. I know this is a bit of an evil question to ask a musician, but maybe just... So if you're going to take three albums away, what would you take? But also, just to make it a bit more fair, maybe three albums that are really connecting with you at the moment.
Okay. So I would say I would love to listen. I would actually like to take this King Kong Jazz South African Jazz Opera album, just because I think it would remind me so much of growing up, my childhood and my family. That would be lovely. I would also love to take Bill Evans's Conversations with Myself, because it's an extraordinary album where he multi-tracked himself. So he recorded himself, listened back and added more, listened back and added more. So it's like six hands playing the piano. So there's a lot of textures in that, and there's so much to listen for. And I always discover something new whenever I'm listening to it. And oh my gosh, it's so hard. I think the third one, I think the third one would probably be something, I think it would be The Little Sweep, which was a children's opera written by Benjamin Britten, which I also grew up listening to. And yeah, that I think is also the real soundtrack to my childhood. So I'd love to kind of connect and keep connected to that part of me.
Oh, Pete, well, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it. I know you're a busy guy, so I appreciate your time. And very much look forward to collaborating with you on the Primary Live, which is going to be amazing. Yeah, I'm definitely, that's going to be the tagline for this episode, be the best at being you. That was magic. So lovely to speak to you.
Thank you so much for having me, and utter pleasure speaking to you. And I can't wait for our Music for Youth concert. It's going to be a ball.
Brilliant. Cheers, Pete.
Lovely. Cheers. Bye.
Bye.